dance on the air. We're here cause we care. We ask all the questions that others don't dare. We're dads on the air. We're back, we're dads on the air.
Good morning and welcome back to Dads on the Air this third day of August 2010. And this is Bill Cable from Mediate Now. And in the studio with me this morning, we have Ian Purdy from ianpurdy.com.
Good morning, everybody.
And we have Phil York from Dads in Distress.
Good morning, everyone.
Well, in today's show, we've got some interesting people to speak to. Regular listeners might recall we had David Dufour in the studio with us back on the 11th of May. And David is putting together a film which is going to be dealing with the topic of maleness in 2010, what it means to be a male in the current times in 2010. Dave's now back in the States, and so he's been doing a lot of interesting things over there, so we'll be having a chat to him. And then our second guest is Coral Slattery, and Coral is the Secretary of the Family Law Reform Association, well known to many people out there who work in the area of doing some good for men in the community. Coral has become a legend in this area, and she's been a tireless worker for improving the conditions for men and for their relationship with their children. And we'll be speaking to her about a number of topics, about the family law in schools policy. We'll be getting an update on Ken Thompson in relation to his drive to improve the law relating to child abduction. And we'll also be speaking to her about grandparents and what's under the family law, what's available under family law for grandparents trying to stay in touch with their children. So it's a big program today. And before we get started, I wanted to mention that there's a conference coming up. Some of us hopefully can attend. The only problem is that it's in New York. This is a conference that's going to be held on the weekend of 2-3 October 2010. And we've been contacted by Joseph Goldberg, who is the founder of a group called the Canadian Symposium for Parental Alienation Syndrome. Now, the symposium is going to be held in New York. They have a number of speakers, and the whole conference is going to be devoted to parental alienation. And this is so important that parental alienation gets a push at the moment, because it's a unique opportunity to have the disorder listed in the DSM, which is the Bible of American psychologists. If we can get parental alienation recognised in the DSM, it would go a long way towards it being recognised in the courts and in the community as something that desperately needs to be addressed. DSM only gets published every 12 to 15 years, so it's very, very important that we get it in this time. So for anyone in Australia interested in attending the conference, he's prepared to have a discount on the registration. He's going to drop it from $195 to $150, and there might be some cheaper hotel rates available. We can keep you posted on that. But anyway, that's something that if anyone is able to attend, it'll be a wonderful thing to go to in New York on the 2nd and 3rd of October. So now, some more news. I think Ian's got some news.
Oh, there's plenty of news. Well, the first one, the major one this morning, screaming at us from all of the newspapers, the headline on the front page of this morning's Daily Telegraph, $37 million sex suit. A picture of Christy Fraser-Kirk. Fife Yeomans has written, Christy Fraser-Kirk yesterday put herself up as a champion for women as she lodged a $37 million sexual misconduct action against David Jones and its former CEO, Mark McInnes. Now, this is a record figure. I mean, to me, this is all just madness. I mean, how does being sexually harassed at work equal $37 million? I really don't get that. Did they chop her arm off? Did they chop her leg off? Is she unable to have sex now? The article goes on to say, as part of the claim, Ms. Fraser-Kirk is seeking punitive damages of $35 million from David Jones, who the company who actually had nothing to do with the sexual harassment. They just happened to employ the two people who were involved. It goes on to say, or 5% of its profits while Mr. McInnes was chief executive. So she believes she's entitled to 5% of what David Jones earned while Mr. McInnes was its CEO because he sexually harassed her. She is also seeking 5% of Mr. McInnes's salary and benefits as chief executive between 2003 and 2010, which is estimated at about $2 million, a paltry $2 million. Which she thinks she is deserved because he apparently continually suggested that she should come back to his place at Bondi and have sex with him after she'd said she didn't want to. Now, look, this brings in a lot of issues here. I just think we're going nuts. If this gets up, I personally think it is insane. The idea that she is being presented as a champion for women is absolute nonsense. I mean, isn't this reverse sexual harassment? Isn't she now sexually harassing David Jones? You know, I mean, the guy quit his job, he's been fired, he's been humiliated publicly. $37 million, somebody say something. I just find this is, you know, we've gone mad. And here is a symptom of it right here in front of us. Why should this cute young chickie, who, you know, she's a good-looking girl, she's attractive, you know, 60% of marriages are a result of people who met at work. You know, I know in my situation with my ex, I mean, I sexually harassed her for a good 12 months before she agreed to come out with me. The result was a beautiful baby boy in a 10-year relationship. I mean, I just don't know where it's all going. I think this is madness.
Well, perhaps we don't want to go into the beginnings of your relationship, Ian, but it's she's being represented by Harmers, and I think the feeling in the legal community is that that she's unlikely to get the $35 million, which is in fact, she, as you mentioned,
$37 million.
Yeah, I think $35 million of that is
punitive damages against. Yep, and the other $2 million from McInnes himself.
Yep, and in Australia we don't have punitive damages in this area, so it seems to be a publicity thing. Which, you know, you can perhaps understand that they're trying to.
Well, she is a publicist. That's actually her job. That was what she was doing for David Jones. So that's her gig, and she's pushing it for all it's worth, I guess. She's on the front picture on the front page, looking lovely, I must say, of most major newspapers this morning.
So she's trying to draw attention to this, and but I think legally it's unlikely she'll get anywhere near that. Anyway, Phil, you've got something for us.
Yeah, thanks, Bill. If everyone can grab a pen, and because I'm going to give you a number very shortly, there's a comedy trivia night in aid of Dads in Distress, Men's Refuge in Maitland. It's going to be a fun-packed night full of trivia and obviously some hilarious comedy. And it's on Saturday, the 14th of August, 2010. Tickets are $50. And for that, it's a 7 o'clock start for a light meal and drinks for an 8 p.m. start of the hilarity. It's at Maitland Senior Citizens Hall, Grant Street, Maitland. And here's the number if anyone would like to go or find out more. They can contact 0427 330 771, and Phil Penfold will be happy to help you further. So yep, get behind that, and it's for a good cause, for the Men's Refuge in Maitland.
Great, that is a good cause for Dads in Distress. Now, there's an article here by Sue Hewitt from the Sunday Herald Sun, which describes an 8-year international hunt for a stolen child, and it's now focusing on Victoria. I guess this has special resonance in view of what we know of Ken Thompson and his efforts to find his abducted child. And he thinks his child is now in Europe somewhere, not knowing where. But in this case, there was the hunt has narrowed down to Victoria, and it's a situation where a father, Brozzi Lunetta, has accused the Australian Federal Police of abandoning their search for his child despite a court order to find her. The child is now 9 years old. Her name is Rhea, and it will be up to a court to decide if Mr. Lunetta can take her home to America because she has been hiding in Australia for so long. That's, of course, if he finds her. They've had a few narrow misses. They've been given a few tip-offs. At one stage, they went to a place where she'd been staying but missed her by 2 weeks. They've also found a place in Melbourne where there have been several sightings. The mother has used the names Camilla Lunetta and Zelma Ellefson, and she's apparently working in the music industry. So you think that's a fairly public occupation, that someone somewhere will have recognised that this is not right, that there's something unusual here. She's part of the music scene in Melbourne. So if anyone happens to know anything of this Camilla Ellefson and the child Zelma Ellefson, perhaps they could let the Australian Federal Police know, and something can be done about getting this child back to her father, and perhaps getting the legal situation sorted out.
Fair enough. I've got one here. This is it just says divorce poor as the heading in this morning's Telegraph. Single women aged over 45 are becoming poor and homeless because of divorce, a new study showed. Ludo McFerrin of the Older Women's Network said women are stricken more often due to separations, social and financial impacts. So there you are, girls. When you read in Clio that booting your husband will mean that you can have more orgasms, this is a only short-term plan. By the time you're 45, you're going to be poor and unhappy. So think twice before you boot hubby out. That's all I can say.
Now, this is a not a good story, but the rate of child abuse in Australia is rising dramatically, according to the first in-depth study to be released on the issue in a decade. This has been reported in Child Abuse, and the author is Laurie Nowell, N-O-W-E-L-L. He has reported that in the 37% of cases of child abuse where a parent was the perpetrator, of those cases, mothers were responsible for 73% of abuse cases.
Wow.
While fathers were the cause of 27%. Now, this data is the first of its kind to emerge since 1996, and it was obtained under the Freedom of Information laws by the West Australian Department of Child Protection. The data shows that fathers are most responsible for sex abuse against children, accounting for more than 85% of cases, but mothers carry out more than 65% of cases of emotional and psychological abuse and about 53% of physical abuse. They are also responsible for about 93% of cases of neglect. In other cases in which the gender of the perpetrator was determined, 463 cases were carried out by women and 353 by men. So comparison with the 2005-2006 data shows that the number of total cases of abuse has risen by more than 50% from 960. University of Western Sydney lecturer Michael Woods said the findings undermined the myth that fathers were the major risk factor for their children's well-being. He said, while there are some abusive fathers, there are in fact a larger proportion of violent and abusive mothers. So it's time to get some of these real facts out there, because it's so easy to spread spread a myth, and they're very hard to kill off once these things get out there.
Well, absolutely. I mean, we've been living under the shadow of a huge load of bullshit. Really, there's no other word for it. And the fact that, I mean, I'm flabbergasted, 73%. I mean, okay, I sit here weekly and hear all of these figures, and I am in tune with the reality to a degree, but that even surprises me. That shocks me. I'm surprised that it is so high, that mothers, I would have thought it would have been similar to domestic violence, a 50-50 split, but that definitely shows that mothers are far more abusive than fathers.
I guess it also shows that as a community, until we realise that this is happening and take ownership of it, it's not going to get any better.
Yeah, well, that's absolutely true. You wonder if there's been any change in reporting standards of abuse or something since, because such a huge jump, you wouldn't imagine that the underlying behaviour had changed so radically. It would appear to me perhaps there's more of a change in the way that these things are being reported, or the way the data's being collated, or...
Well, I think, you know, families out there are under huge amounts of stress. And, you know, when you talk about the separated families and it's just mum trying to look after the kids and there's all that added stress, and because that load of looking after the kids isn't shared, mum ends up blowing a stack.
Yeah. Well, look, Are we ready to move on? Because I've got another one here, which it's kind of a nice little neat segue here. The heading is Parents Caught by Drug Test. This may be something to do with how parents are coping with these stresses. Kate Sakura has written in this morning's Telegraph, more than 80 parents were found taking drugs such as cocaine, ice and cannabis during a trial by docs to determine if children should be reunited with their families. At least half of all mothers and fathers targeted in the parental drug test had taken marijuana, according to docs documents. This trial was conducted between 2007 and 2008. Also found that many parents were taking multiple drugs, with many addicted to methamphetamines and heroin. I mean, so what does this say? You know, I mean, society is getting very, very sick. We're self-medicating to deal with it. I mean, parents taking, you know, these dangerous illegal drugs. I mean, I've expressed my opinion before. I think we've lost the war on drugs, and all drugs should be legalized, and the whole thing should be brought out of the alley, out of the dark, and up into the light, where we can see exactly what is going on and deal with it intelligently. As opposed to the situation we've got at the moment, where we basically victimise the victims, lock people with drug habits in jail. The dealers are running around driving Mercedes and, you know, buying continents and houses and trading and all sorts of things. I mean, there's huge amounts of money being made that should be in the normal economy. So that's my opinion on all of that. Next.
Well, just finally, we've spoken before about prevalence of male suicide. And there's an article here showing that that is a similar problem in the USA, where, according to a 1999 Surgeon General's report, suicide is the eighth leading cause of death in America, with men four times more likely to kill themselves than women. Prevalence of male suicide is not restricted to Australia or North America. It seems to be a worldwide trend, with statistics from Ireland and the UK indicating rates of male suicide as high as five times that of women. Indeed, a recent study found that suicide was the leading cause of death for Irish men between 15 and 34 years old. And the research also points to a probable cause. According to sociologist Augustine Caposao of the University of California, divorce and the loss of children is a factor. As far as the divorced man is concerned, he's lost his marriage, lost his children, and that can lead to depression and suicide. So it's a worldwide problem. It's something we have to do something about. And, of course, Phil York here from Dads in Distress is on the front line in dealing with these problems. We can only hope that there is some improvement and we can get that rate down. It's such a loss to the community.
Hear, hear.
Absolutely. I have to echo that one.
All right, we might go to a short break and we'll be back with our first guest.
Gave me an agony. They grow so fast. You have to cherish every moment.
Please, Daddy.
You have a right to be involved in the life of your child. Dad's in Distress, 1300 853 437.
We're back with Dad's on the Air.
Welcome back to Dad's on the Air, this third day of August 2010, and this is Bill Cable from Mediate Now. I think on the line we have Dave Dufour. Are you there, Dave?
I am. Can you hear me?
We can hear you. It's. I think you're on your cell phone, so hopefully we won't have any breaks. But, Dave, it's been a long time since we've heard the news. Our listeners might remember you were in the show. You're on the show on May 11 when you were filming for your movie. I was just wondering if you can give us an update on some of the adventures you've been through.
That's true. You know, Australia was my first leg on the trip because you have so much going on there for men. It was just, you know, it's always a pleasure to hear, you know, what you're doing on the air, and your archives, I think, are just a tremendous resource for everyone that might be looking into the issues of men and boys today. I just finished a 40-day wander in the wilderness here. It was supposed to be 2 weeks, a round trip around the U.S., interviewing people about what it's like to be a guy in 2010. It was a wild, really a wild and woolly trip. Everything from, you know, hailstorms and tornadoes, almost tornadoes, and lightning storms to caverns and, of course, the cavernous halls, streets of New York City, to the caverns of New Mexico. We have Carlsbad Caverns where you could fit two or three city blocks in one room of this cavern down there. So it was a hugely mixed and wonderful, magical trip. And an odyssey in trying to find out what it means to be male in 2010.
Well, yes, the last note I had from you was you were in southeast Montana, I think, near the site of Custer's Last Stand, and you'd won a prize for Mustang owners, and I think in the course of that you were talking to a man and a dad and two sons who were traveling in a rented motorhome. I didn't hear what the stories were, but it sounded pretty good.
Well, there was, and those are just samples of incredible things that happened along the way. Of course, the first day out, I'm from Seattle, and Seattle's in the northwest corner of the country, right up against the ocean there. And if you want to, I realize I have to turn the phone down when I'm talking. The first thing I did was I left Seattle and I drove to the top of the mountain range that's nearby here, prepared to descend on the country from there. And when I woke up in the morning, there was this traffic jam up ahead of me, and I'd heard that there could be a lot of heavy traffic. It was a Memorial Day weekend, a holiday 3-day weekend here. And so I went back to sleep, and when I woke up again, I was reading my manuals and my new camera manuals and so on. And I looked up again, and darned if those cars weren't still there. And I realized they were the same cars, and then they were all Mustangs like mine. I drive a 2010 Mustang, which I bought with the trip in mind here. So I drove over and talked to them, and they were from a car show, and they were all going to a car show. And I asked them, and they asked me to go along with them. And I thought that would be a nice little segment for the film, actually. So that was the first thing that happened, and right off the bat. And then I won first place in the car show because I was the only one in my class with a 210 Mustang that was all stock. So that was exciting right off the bat.
As far as the movie's going, Dave, are you what sort of stories are you? Are you getting some hopeful messages coming out about the state of men in 2010?
You know, I was just thinking about that. You know, I was thinking about your... how long have you guys been on the air now? 10 years?
Yep, you've got it.
Okay, so your theme song, you know, it says, "We ask all the questions that others don't dare." Hmm. And I think that state of affairs, sadly, is the same today as it was when that song was written. I wish I could say things were hopeful, but I did I did encounter some points of light along the way. And one of them is one of the people that you've interviewed before, which is Miles Groff from,
yes.
From New York, who's trying to start a male studies program. And just the idea of starting this needs so much thought, needs so much. We have to think so many new thoughts in order to get a program like that even accepted. And the fact that we have to think so many new thoughts is a sad state of affairs, I think. But the idea is when you mention a program like that, people automatically say, well, you know, you want to study men? You know, well, haven't we studied men forever? Isn't that what the state of affairs is in, you know, the civilized universe? And the answer is no, of course. People say men have been, is what history is all about. It's a history of men. And, well, that's not true either. History is the history of history. And it's no one studied the history of men, for instance, the way that we have studied the history of women when it comes to women's studies programs and other women-centered programs. So women are, women and the study of women is light years ahead of what's out there for men. And this one man is trying to get this set up. And fortunately, he's in a position to where people will listen to him because he is a tenured professor at Wagner College. And they did hold a symposium here just a few months ago. It was widely attended, internationally attended on the web. There is hope. There is that hope. But as you know, it's an uphill battle right now. And I think that history is going to look back at this time and really see those who are trying to do something about it as pioneers, just as the pioneers that I have been, the pioneer mentality and ethic and romance that I've been driving through here for the last, 40 days or so, crossing America.
Yes, it sounds like 40 days out in the wilderness, like another story that comes to mind, but...
It was ringing true. Yeah, I did get to eat, though, along the way.
Oh, that's good. That's good. And, yes, I remember when we spoke to Dr. Groth, and we've all come to accept women's studies as quite a normal discipline at a university, but men's studies is something different. And let's hope he's a trailblazer if he can get that up over there.
That's right. Yeah. Well, I think a lot of people would be well served, but he definitely makes the point. We did it. It was a great interview. He talks like a professor. As he says, professors talk in 55-minute sentences. So he's going to require some editing down to pull out the commas, you know. But he does make a very strong case, I think, for studying this. One of the things that he points to is the deep psychology of males is different than females. Our endocrine system is different. And, of course, there's well-known research on oxytocin and how, which is called the cuddle hormone. And, you know, when something goes wrong, you want to cry and you want to hold on to somebody and want to socialize. And that's true for women and girls and boys until they hit puberty. But as soon as that testosterone level jumps up in the human being, it has the opposite effect of that. And those males then, after puberty, don't want to cuddle when something goes wrong. They don't want to cry. They want to go off and do something. And they want to go to their man cave and think about it or work it out, or they want to go off and act in the world. And, you know, so this is one of the things, I'm theorizing a little bit that has moved civilization past its obstacles over time. Is when things, when the going gets tough, the tough get going. Well, you know, the tough guys are the men. They think of themselves as the tough guys, and for this reason, maybe alone. But this is just one tiny little thing. It's one hormone, and we have so many other things that we haven't even scratched the surface of yet. With men that needs to be studied.
Yes. And is there, in travelling around, I mean, I think in the US it's pretty much a state thing rather than a federal thing. Are you noticing a lot of differences between the states? Are some states more advanced than others?
Well, there are differences in culture within the U.S. And, you know, if you go to the South, it's one thing. If you go to the, you know, a cowboy country, I was actually just thinking, they have a sense of rightness and how to act in public. Maybe the coast don't share or go, you know, and if you're in a city and a coast, it's just anything goes. But if you're in the heartland, you know, there's a code of expectation of people expect you to be a certain way. I don't know how much you can generalize about that, or what it might mean and translate into behavior, but there is a sense of rightness there, you know. If you get to the coast, either coast, it's pretty much generally the same story as all through history. When you interact with other cultures, and generally that's true of coastal cities, you tend to be more liberal because you're meeting people from, you know, other cultures and so on. But I would say there are differences. Now, as far as advances for men, I'd say we're pretty flat across the board, you know. Except that it's more like where do you see excesses in the women's movement, and you see less of that in the heartland and more of it in the university cities of the country.
Mm. And how's the film going, Dave? Is it sort of getting towards a shape where it's, you can think about a date for producing it or for distributing it?
Well, an interesting thing has happened on that front. I was, this was always a launch and not knowing where it was going to end up. And that's actually the way I wanted it to be. I really wanted to do something that wasn't completely planned all the way through. I didn't want to say, you know, I'm going to set out to prove this or that. But one thing I didn't know was how I was going to get this into distribution, that's a dark continent for me. A little alarm went off on my phone here. But when I was sitting over in the Grand Canyon area, I had my camera literally hanging over the edge of the Grand Canyon, taking a time-lapse movie of the clouds going by. A woman walked up and asked me what I was doing. When I told her, she said, "Well, you know, I go to this film institute down the street, in Sedona, and it looks like I'm going to be going back to school to finish this movie."
Yeah.
So I'm trying to arrange everything right now to go to the Zaki Film Institute. I don't know if it's going to happen or not. It's a really a left turn for me, so I don't know where I'm going to come up with all the money and the living expenses for doing that. But I'm struggling, and if I can do it, I will. And in 3 weeks I'll be in school.
Yep. And so the film is. The film is still based on your experiences in Australia and the US. At one stage, I think you were planning to go to the UK as well. Is that still a possibility?
I don't think it's going to be possible, no. No, I've kind of written that part off. As far as a live trip, is concerned, it's still possible to pull information, of course, but as far as actually going there, I think that's going to be out of the question at this point. I can't see it. I can't see it. Maybe something miraculous will happen, but it would take an angel funding or something like that to make that happen.
Yeah, well, you never know. And what do you think are the main things you've learned in making the film?
Well, of course, I've learned a lot about the technology, but I think you're asking another question. What really is something that I run into every day when I talk to people about. I'm trying to
meet them. Wait a minute, sorry. Dave, you were just breaking up there. Could you just say that again, sorry?
Yes. Well, every day I want to get out and I talk to men about what impacts of this man. You know, it takes some digging because one of the problems is right now, there's no body of thought out there. There's no place, there's no go-to for information that men share. You know, Dads on the Air and other organizations are largely people that are hearing this message today are people who have come to consciousness because of the divorce process. But when you look around and you just want to just talk to anybody about, you know, here's a crowd of people, you're going to walk up to them, you're going to ask them questions about what it means to be male today in 2010, you know, they're going to just go, well, wait a minute, you know, I never thought about this. I don't have any thoughts for you on the subject that are ready or stuff that I've been thinking about. On the most part, I talked to a car salesman who was telling me about what it's like to, you know, get dates, you know, and stuff like that. Or another guy talking to me about what it's like to get a job and those kinds of things. But as far as what it means to be male, there aren't, you know, the primal thought throughout the society just isn't ready you know, on the spot when you ask them a question.
So your probing might in fact lead to some more thought on it, and perhaps it might get included in Dr. Groth's course at some stage.
You know, that was interesting because at one point I said, you know, I was syncing up with him on the trip out there, and I said, you know, I want to stop and I want to talk to people in museums, which I actually never did get to do, because my first tries were, you know, so futile. I just thought, you know, I'm going to bag it. But I wanted to see if there was any material in museums about what it was like to be a guy traveling across the country then, you know. Is it the same as we might think it is today? As we're, you know, we're guys. We might travel across the country, but what is it? What was it like to be a pioneer? What did they think of themselves as men to be doing this? You know, he said, "Yeah, that, you know, that could be a great, you know, the historical aspect of this. It could be a primary of men's male studies."
Well, I think it has changed, particularly in the last, perhaps this century, perhaps even the last 50, when I say this century, I mean from 1900 on, I think there has been an enormous change, and it'd be very interesting to study how that's expressed itself in the community. And I guess that's part of what your film is about, is is tracing the maleness at different stages.
Yeah, you know, that's a good point because, you know, you've got the pioneering guy, you've got the industrialized man, and then you've got today's information world man too. So, and then now we have a completely different society where, you know, it used to be all about guys, and today in a sense of all about guys, meaning guys were it, and you know, guys made all the decisions, everything. But today it's mixed roles in the family, and so we do have a very different and more complex way of living today. But the role change for males has not been studied and not been elucidated, and men themselves don't elucidate it when you actually ask them the questions, like I said earlier.
And we're speaking with Dave Dufour, who's making a movie on the state of maleness in 2010. Dave, and have you noticed similarities between the Australian and the Americans? The Australians and the Americans?
Say again, please?
Have you noticed similarities or differences between the state of maleness in Australia and the state of maleness in the USA?
Well, I think there's a couple layers, millions of layers to that, but, you know, on one front, you guys are way, way ahead of us in that you actually have governmental institutions set up to help men, specifically men. Here, all the governmental institutions are set up to help women, and they are basically, to use the word, misandric against men. So, you know, they're just... I did an interview here with a young man on domestic violence just about a week or two ago, and he was saying in Washington State, if you call on domestic violence, you're probably going to go to jail. Mm-hmm. They have to take somebody under state law. With somebody, if they show up in Seattle, if the cops come, they have to take somebody, one of you, to jail. And 99% of the time, it's going to be the guy. So, I mean, they look at her, they look at him, nobody's got any bruises, nobody's crying, you know, they're going to take the guy. Mm. And so in addition to all the classic ways that you guys report on, you know, I know you've got people that are, Greg Anderson, for instance, who work very strongly on this issue. The guy's going to be a wimp if he calls, you know, or if he reports that he's being beaten or something. Or, you know, constantly deranged by his loved one's aunt. Well, here you have all of those things too, but then you also have the threat that you are going to be arrested if you report domestic violence against you.
Mm.
So we are backwards. We're way backwards from where you guys are, and you know, hopefully some things will change.
That's frightening.
I think to be in that position is, you know, a guy, I say this, and it's really true. I think a lot of guys today are in the position of, you know, where a black woman in the Deep South was, you know, 100 years ago, if she reported rape, you know, she would just be out of luck. And you know, and laughed at, and berated by the system for, you know, making herself available, or she asked for it, or something like this. Okay, but this is where guys are today. Different set of words accompanies it, but you know, the system is against the guy who reports a crime if it's DV.
Mm. Yeah, well, look, that's disturbing. I was hoping that it might have been a bit better story over there, but it sounds like it might even be worse than we experience in Australia.
Well, I don't think it's all, you know, it's not all black and white, and I do live in what one person has said is a woman's state, you know, the state of Washington. It's very, very feminized here. And I don't think the people who live here, it's like a toad, you know, the story, but you put a frog in some warm water and then heat it up to boiling. I don't think the people that live here realize how bad it really is.
Yeah, well, look, hopefully your film, when it comes out, will raise that level of awareness, Dave. And, Dave, I think we're getting short of time, but, look, thank you very much for coming on the show and for giving us the update. And we'd like to stay in touch and follow you in your adventures and as we get closer to the actual film being released.
Well, I definitely can stay in touch with you. I think you guys are great. You're a beacon of light down there, and I think for everywhere. I tell everybody about you and the archives that you keep. I say to everybody out there, you know, don't ever think that you're alone or that you're in vain. You guys are just totally great, and you're really carrying the torch.
Well, thank you very much, Dave, and we wish you every success too in your movie, and we'll talk to you again before too long. Thanks for coming on the show.
Okay.
Thanks, Dave.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Us and them, girls that wore pink, boys that wore blue, boys that always grew up better men than me and you. What's a man now? What's a man mean? Is he rough or is he rugged? Is he cultural and clean? Now it's all changed. It's got to change more, cause we think it's getting better, but nobody's really sure. And so it goes, go round again, but now and then we wonder who the real men are. Whoa.
suntan and blow wave in the hair. Short arrow straight, straight as a line. All the gays are macho, can't you see the leather shine? You don't want to sound dumb, don't want to offend, so don't call me a faggot, not unless you are a friend. Then if you're tall and handsome and strong, you can wear the uniform and I could play along. And so it goes, go round again, but now and then we wonder who the real men are. Whoa, oh, 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 oh. Time to get scared, time to change plan. Don't know how to treat a lady, don't know how to be a man. Time to admit what you call defeat, cause there's women running past you now and you just drag your feet. Man makes a gun, man goes to war. Man can kill and man can drink and man can take a whore. Kill all the blacks, kill all the reds. And if there's war between the sexes, then there'll be no people left. And so it goes, go round again, but now and then we wonder who the real men are. Whoa,
so fast. You have to cherish every moment.
Please, Daddy.
You have a right to be involved in the life of your child.
What do you care? It's not like you were ever there anyway.
Dads in Distress meet in your area every week. If you're a non-custodian parent and would like to know who to contact or just want someone to talk to, help is just a phone call away. Dads in Distress, 1300 853 437 or dadsindistress.asn.au.
We're back. Dad's on the air.
And welcome back to Dad's on the Air this third day of August 2010. And our guest now is Coral Slattery, who's the Secretary of the Family Law Reform Association. Coral, are you there?
Yes, I am, Bill.
Oh, thank you. And Coral is a legend in this area. She's she was a founder of the Family Law Reform Association, and that's been running for 20 years. Is that right, Coral?
Yes, that's right.
20 years of doing this.
March 1990.
So, it's wonderful work that's been done by the association since then. They pride themselves on giving advice and assistance with family law problems. There are group discussions at meetings where everyone has an opportunity to have your say, and you can, more importantly, get some assistance from people who've been through the same sort of problems. And you've successfully lobbied for changes to the family law in a way that's made it fairer for all. And I guess the first thing I want to talk to you about, Coral, is the family law in schools policy, which you were instrumental in improving.
Yes. Would you like me to give you a bit of history with regards to what happened?
Yes, please.
Well, in 1994, we invited the late Virginia Chadwick, who was the Minister for Education in the state at that time, because of all the problems with mainly men not knowing anything about their children's schooling. We did have one woman in our group at the time also. Well, of course, when Virginia Chadwick arrived, she started to hear all these stories, and she was quite horrified that some parents hadn't seen their children for a long time, let alone anything about their schooling. So by the end of the night, one of the female mother that was there, she said she was really crying on Virginia's shoulder. So Virginia promised to do something about it, and she got in touch with the education department. And then our association was invited to draw up... they already had a family law in the school's policy, but it was quite inadequate. So they asked us to draw up, help with the drafting of another one. Now, my son and Richard Long, who were both previous presidents, got together and they drafted a policy that would suit... both parents. So after that, they sent this out to other groups for their comments as well. And in 1997, they put out their second edition of Family Law and the School's Policy. Now, that has been working quite well, but they were actually only guidelines for the principals. Now, in 2007, they put out a new one. It's a broader version of the first one. It's called Dealing with Family Law Related Issues in Schools and TAFE New South Wales. And it's guidelines for school and institute staff. They are along the lines now of not making or not being the adjudicator. So it's I was just having a quick look at it here now. It's just a broader version of the original one, but it has worked very well. Now, what we want to do, because of the problems with getting independent schools to endorse this, the Catholic schools did, so they've endorsed it. But we decided to try and get a national family law and the schools policy, which would cover the whole of Australia. And that would mean that because private schools or independent schools get a significant amount of funding, government funding, there should be a proviso in there that yes. they abide by the guidelines of a national family law and the school's policy.
Look, absolutely, and I mean, my experience is that some of these small independent schools, some of them are fundamentalist religious schools, they answer to a local board. They're quite happy to take government money, but they do not feel That's themselves bound by the policy.
Yes, exactly right. And, of course, the state schools, some of the principals don't know about it, and they have to be reminded. So if anyone's having a problem, they could go to our website, which is www.familylawreform.org.au, and click on the children's issues. They'll find a link to the New South Wales Family Law and the School's Policy, and they'll be able to read up on it themselves.
Yes, and that has to be done, because I've seen situations, I know from very personal experience, that sometimes it gets caught between two stools, where the state member, if you go and see your local member, says, oh no, it's a federal issue, and then you go and see the federal member, and the federal member says, no, it's a state issue, and it seems to get lost in the middle.
Yes, well, I can't see much point in going to your member about this, because there is a set of guidelines that should be available to all school principals. And I did have a man ring me the other day, and he said that his principal was the principal said to him, look, you know, if I give you copies of school reports, etc., I'd have to do it for everyone. Well, so be it.
Yes.
I mean, what's the big problem? Another stamp.
That's right.
Posted out to the father. There is no problem as far as I can see.
Yes, I mean, it's probably pretty straightforward for the state schools. It's the independent schools I guess we have the problems.
Right. And we can't lobby every independent school. Mm. And we can't lobby every independent state.
No. And
we just don't have the resources to do that.
And what are the main problems, Coral? I mean, I'm thinking of names that children enrolled in would be one.
Yes.
And
well, I've just noticed this here, that... where was I reading it? But the children have to be... Oh, here we are. Except in specifically defined circumstances which are outlined in the guidelines, it is mandated that a student must be enrolled using the name that appears on his or her birth certificate.
Hmm. That sounds pretty straightforward. So,
straightforward.
Thanks to all the good work you've done at state schools, that seems to be very clear. And
yes.
And
there's,
I suppose,
somewhere else that it says that parents are entitled to know where their children are enrolled.
Yes, that's another big point.
Coral, it's Phil from Dads in Distress.
Yes,
how are you going? Can I just add to that?
Yes.
It does say in the policy, though, that if one parent goes into the school and is willing to sign a stat deck to say that the other parent has no contact, et cetera, which, you know, could possibly not be the case.
Well,
that the school will accept an enrolment under a different name.
For instance, I'm only going on what my idea of reading it is, that if a child is in danger of the other parent, there might be special circumstances. And also, if there are court orders in place, then those court orders have to be recognised.
That's right, but that's providing that the school is aware that there are court orders in place.
Yes, but the mother or the father must produce those orders. Mm. They just can't go on hearsay.
Mm.
But seriously, there's nothing stopping a mother from going to a school who has court orders, says that there's no court orders in place, says that dad has been out of the picture for 5 years or more, signs a stat deck to reflect that information. The principal must accept it and enrol that child in whatever name the mum says.
Well, I don't think that's correct somehow. It only states that if court orders are in place.
Yeah, obviously, if there's an order.
So the technicalities of it, Phil, might be worth looking into. But
yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
I can only look at it generally, and that's the general opinion, and that's what's written in here.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm just acting on, and I'm sure you get lots of stories as well, Coral, from dads, but, you know, there are situations out there which are quite damning and ugly, and, you know, these things do happen, and unless this policy comes down to those finer points. You know, like, if I can just talk about the first point under enrolment, it says here, enrolment in a school is regarded as a major long-term issue.
Yes.
In the absence of any court orders to the contrary, any decision about enrolment must be made jointly by both parents. A school's decision should accord with the parent's decision. Now, here comes the bit. There is no requirement, however, for school staff to independently establish that any decision to enrol in a particular school has been made jointly by the parents.
Well, according to my belief, they don't want the staff to get involved in the issues unless it's absolutely necessary. They prefer the staff to stay out of it. And I would think that these guidelines, if they abide by these guidelines, it would mean that the staff wouldn't have to adjudicate on anything. They just say, well, that's the policy.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm.
Yeah, and that's what I think that's what we're trying to get to is you just want the schools to play it down the middle without favouring either side.
And there is. They do make mention of that here, that they shouldn't favour any parent.
Mm.
But we have to keep working at it. But with the family relationship centres, etc., you know, we hope that that parents will try to agree that their children's education is is extremely important, and you know, it's up to them to try and get some middle ground.
Mm.
Yeah.
And have you got any other projects on the go at the moment at the Family Law Reform Association?
Oh, yes. We've got Ken Thompson pushing his bike around Europe. And I haven't heard from him for a week, but the last I heard, he was at The Hague in the Netherlands, and he was presenting a letter to the Deputy General, I think it was, with regards to abducted children and missing children, and how the Convention on Abducted Children doesn't necessarily meet all the needs. For instance, there's a case where a man's child, a son, was abducted to Poland by the mother, and he knew that the child was there. They are signatories to the Hague Convention, and yet the Polish court still won't respect the Hague Convention and return the child to Australia. Now, that's in contravention of the Hague Convention.
Mm.
It says that a child must be returned to their habitual residence or their place of origin. So that's the case there. And the Hague Convention, of course, is only good if you know where your child is. And yes. Ken Thompson doesn't know where his child is.
Mm.
So it's it has a... Because I had personal dealings with that 20 years ago when my grandson was abducted to England. So nothing much has changed.
Mm.
You have to know where the child is. Now, with regards to Ken, he's riding his push bike. I mean, it's a great story, a man riding a push bike all over the UK and Europe trying to find his son, who's been gone now for 2 years.
Mm.
So I haven't heard from Ken since. He has a website, www.findandrew.com, I think it is, and he's had a lot of media coverage overseas, very little here, which I think is extraordinary.
Yes, we've had Ken on the show, and
you had him on, did you?
We did have him on, and we've tried to stay in touch with him, but it's proved a bit difficult just to getting that communication right. I think we spoke to him once, and it was 2 o'clock in the morning where he was. Which
yes. Have you got his new phone number?
No, look, I might get that from you off
right.
air, and
yes.
because we'd certainly like to get back in touch with him and
yes.
find out how he's going.
All right. And we've also, I put out a book, Grandparents Family Law Information Guide. I did that in 2008 for the New South Wales Seniors Week. And in that, I've got a little note from Andrew Corrish, our honorary solicitor, advising grandparents on their situation. And also in that book is, or it's a booklet, it's got where to go for help and, you know, phone numbers and the family relationship centres and where they're located and the children's contact centres. So that's in there, and, you know, if anyone wanted a copy of that, they could yes. either get it off our website, www.familylawreform.org.au, and download it, or if they can't do that, I will just ring me and I'll send them a copy.
Great, and because this is another string to your bow, Coral, you're also a mediator and counsellor, and...
Yes.
This perhaps falls under that heading, or some of this does anyway. I think the one of your chapters there in Grandparents Family Law Information Guide is What is Mediation? So you'd
yes.
recommend that the grandparents try and go into a mediation, would you?
Oh, yes, yes. I believe that everyone should go into mediation. because I think that sometimes that's the only way that people can sort out their issues without, you know, fighting.
Yes, I mean, there are provisions in the Family Law Act now for grandparents, but you wouldn't wish that on anybody, I think, going to the Family Law Court.
Well, you see, grandparents, unfortunately, have reached the end of their working life in a lot of cases, and they don't have the money to go to court, etc., and they really don't want to, and they're a bit frightened.
Mm.
So I think that... you know, this booklet gives them a bit of a guide on, you know, what where to go without costing you too much.
Yes, because the grandparents are the collateral damage, really, aren't they, in these breakups?
I used to say, you know, the grandparents provide the stability for children when the parents are divorcing, etc. So grandparents are very... very important people in this world.
Mm. And I suppose that all the extended family come into that category as well, that they all get cut out.
Yes, that's right. And, I mean, just because parents are divorcing doesn't mean to say that the child has to miss out on half his family.
Mm.
That's wrong.
And so, Coral, with your the work you're doing with Family Law Reform, if people now want to talk to you and get some counselling or get some advice or perhaps join the association, everyone should go to that website you've referred to?
Yes, yes. It might need a bit updating, but it has the general knowledge on it. We meet on the first Monday of each month. It used to be at Bankstown RSL. It's now at Bankstown Sports Club. We had a meeting last night, and our next meeting is the 6th of September at 7:30 at night. So everyone is welcome to come along.
That's great. And so at those meetings, all sorts of things get raised. I think it might be your problems in seeing your children. It could be a grandparent, or it could be problems with the spouse.
Yes. We try... And, you know, we try to have our honorary solicitor there as well, Andrew Corrish, to answer any questions that they might have. It's a formal meeting to start with, and then the rest of the night is for people to talk about their problems.
Yeah, and I've been to many of those meetings, and, of course, it can get pretty emotional at times, but it's great to have that support there of people who've been through it, isn't it?
Yes, but we want people to feel comfortable, and they can talk because everyone in the room understands.
Yep. Yeah. Well, Coral, you've been doing a wonderful job for 20 years.
20 and,
years. If you say it quickly, it doesn't sound that long. But, 20 years. And,
20 years.
And you've certainly built up that wonderful reputation and well-deserved. And Family Law Reform Association is doing a wonderful job. So
thank you.
I'd like to thank you again for coming on the program, telling us about some of the achievements. As I say, the Family Law and Schools policy, I think, is an absolute milestone. It's a wonderful achievement.
Yes. We have to get it national.
That's right.
It's the only way that we can have everyone working the same, and all the schools will be under the one set of rules.
Yes, I think I've looked at the Victorian and the Queensland legislation, which I think they might have already been influenced by the work you've done in New South Wales, because they seem to be going in the right track.
Yeah.
But it's just so important that that with, you know, so many marriages breaking down, the high percentage of marriage breakdown in schools, some schools act as though it's never happened to them before. You know, they've never had a split family.
Yes. Well, it's becoming more common, and it's not fair to ask the principals and staff to adjudicate, make a decision. So hopefully, if the policy is adhered to, then, you know, we'll see a cooling off, shall we say, of animosity with the parents.
Yes. Well,
because both parents are entitled to know how their child is at school.
Yes, and I while we're on that, I suppose the other one is dads going along to the school and wanting to see their children at school, and they're sometimes excluded from the school or treated like a trespasser, aren't they?
Yeah, well, that shouldn't be the case either, because if you read through the policy, it says unless someone is causing a disturbance, they should be allowed to go to parent-teacher nights, etc. But they can, because they have more than one, perhaps, one night, then they can arrange to go on different nights.
Yes.
Can be sorted out.
Yes, and look, I think a lot of dads need to be aware of this, because I think they just get intimidated right up front and just think they can't go. But and as you said before, I mean, as far as sending out school reports, we're talking about one extra stamp. I mean,
one stamp.
It's...
You know, one stamp to make sure that both parents are informed. The idea years ago would be that they dealt with one parent, which was the custodial parent in those days, and that parent was supposed to then forward on the school reports, etc., which wasn't happening.
No.
And it made the non-custodial parent have to beg. For information.
Yes, there should be that direct communication between the non-custodial parent and the school without having to rely on the custodial parent.
Yes.
And also, there are sometimes things that are given to the children to take home in their school bag that may not be part of a regular newsletter, but just sort of permission notes and things like that. Is that covered under the policy?
I'm not sure about that. They're supposed to get newsletters, but really, you know, I think it possibly would be a bit much to ask for every week to be sent something. I think that perhaps it's in the guidelines here, but I can't recall.
It is, Coral. It says
is
here
that?
Under
that's you, Phyllis.
Yeah. Under point 12.6, the material provided to non-residential parents should include copies of documentation that is considered significant by the principal and which is ordinarily provided to the parent with whom the child lives. These include reports, test results, school welfare, discipline documentation, school newsletters, notices regarding major excursions, etc., etc.
Right. Would that be on a weekly basis?
Well, it says if it's normally supplied to the parent with whom the child lives, it should also be made available to non-residential parents.
Yes. Well, I can't see a problem with that. I really can't. And school photos too.
Yeah.
They used to be an issue. I remember one man, he was lucky enough to get a copy of the school, what do you call them, the magazines, and he looked through it and he said, I think that's my daughter there. Now, that was terrible.
Yeah, absolutely.
He hadn't seen her for years.
So some of this really, you have to take it up yourself. I mean, if you know the policy, you're on firm ground. But really, the dads need to go to the schools and talk to the principals and get some sort of relationship going, don't they?
Get a copy of the guidelines. You know where you stand, and then you could go to the principal and put your case.
So those guidelines, are they available on your website, or where should they?
The guidelines. I'm suggesting that you go through our website because it's a difficult one to find on the Education Department website. So if you go onto our website, and I gave you the website, Children's Issues, and you'll find a link to it from there.
That's great.
Directly to it.
And we're speaking with Coral Slattery, who's the Secretary of the Family Law Reform Association. Coral, I think we're running out of time, but look, thank you very much for filling us in on all those different topics and those areas that you're working in, and we can only wish you all the strength for another 20 years.
Yeah. I don't think so.
So.
Thanks, Bill.
Thanks again for coming on the show.
Thanks, Bill.
Thanks, Coral.
Right here. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Coral.
Bye.
Dads in Distress, meet in your area every week. If you're a non-custodian parent and would like to know who to contact or just want someone to talk to, help is just a phone call away. Dads in Distress, 1300 853 437 or dadsindistress.asn.au.
We're back with Dads on the Air.
Welcome back to Dads on the Air, this third day of August 2010. And just following up on our interview with Coral Slattery a few minutes ago, we'll be attempting to get in contact with Ken Thompson, who is riding his bike around Europe trying to raise awareness of the problems of child abduction, and in particular his own son Andrew, who was abducted from Australia, last seen at Frankfurt Airport. And we can only wish him some success in finding Andrew, and also for the more general benefit of parents whose children have been abducted. It's all very well talking about the Hague Convention, but as Coral said, if the court doesn't want to enforce the Hague Convention, what do you do then? Now, there's just another bit of news that's come across our desk in here. There's a bit of good news from England this time, where a shared parenting bill has been presented in the House of Commons. Brian Binley, who's a Conservative MP for Northampton South, has presented to the House of Commons a bill on shared parenting. The purpose of the bill is to make it easier for both parents to stay in a child's life following separation or divorce. And naturally, it will provide safeguards in those cases where it's deemed that shared parenting was not the best solution. But this is a great start. Something that Senator Fielding tried to introduce in the Australian government about the time of the 1996 changes, which might yet have its day, where the presumption is that there will be equal shared time, and which making appropriate allowances for situations where that's not suitable. So it's good to see that there's
progress. Some action, something positive going on in the world.
On the other side of the world, yes?
Yes.
Now, also, I just wanted to mention our show for next week. If you're tuning in next week, I mentioned earlier the Canadian Symposium for Parental Alienation Syndrome are having their annual conference in New York City on October 2010. And next week we're hoping to have the founder of the of that symposium, Joseph Goldberg, and he'll be we'll be getting him on the phone to talk about the symposium, and I know he's very anxious to have some Australian attendance at the conference. So that will be that's something to look forward to next week, and we'll also be speaking with local academic Thea Brown. So again, that's going to be a big show next week, and we hope you can join us. Until then, we've got any other items here.
What do you got there, Bill? Shuffling papers away frantically on the other side of the desk there. Help you out. I haven't got anything over here. I think
disappointing situation, I suppose, if that's the word. But there's been some press lately. An article by Andrew Bolt, who is a very well-known right-wing commentator in Victoria, but he has documented the storing, which he describes as the lynching of Theo Theophanous, who was the Labor minister falsely accused of rape. And it's quite an extraordinary story, where the Age, or at least one of the reporters of the Age, took on this story and was first published in October 2008. And there was a front page exclusive interview with a woman who claimed she'd been raped by Theo Theophanous. Not disclosed was that she was in fact a friend of the woman who made this allegation. Not disclosed also was the name of the woman, but that didn't stop this whole story going ahead. And it, when it went to court, it didn't even get past the first stage of the before the magistrate. The magistrate Peter Reardon threw the case out against Theophanous at the committal stage, ruling that the woman making the allegation, so we can call her Helen, that's not her real name, but he ruled that Helen was a completely unreliable witness and no jury could convict on the evidence. The court heard that the sexual crime squad detective who took Helen's statement took 15 months and an extraordinary 15 drafts to try and knock it into some plausible shape. But he kept finding inconsistencies. And unfortunately, the Age reporter seemed to be involved in some of these inconsistencies, where he got her to change the date of the alleged attack. There were allegations made that she'd previously been assaulted by another man, and that all turned to sand. Quite an extraordinary story. I think what Andrew Bolt has distilled out of this, he says there are five lessons. First, this tyranny of being able to point the finger must be resisted. Secondly, we should be slower to grant anonymity to those making these devastating allegations against public figures, with no such protection from being named, shamed and finished. That's the public figures aren't. Thirdly, we should remember that the plural of rumour is not evidence. Fourth, we must defy the modern convention that some allegations are so sacred that it's a sin to question them. These most notably include allegations of rape, racism and global warming. Global warming is a particular one of Andrew Bolt's. Lastly, we should never forget that every journalist has an agenda. It's just that some do not declare them when it matters most. But as a result of these allegations, Theo Theophanous is paid with his career and his name. And it's just one of those very unfortunate things where it's easy to make the allegation, not stand behind it and get it front page news. The only good news is that the two reporters have still got their job. In any event, we've run out of time for this week. We'll be back with that big show next week, and we look forward to seeing you then. So in the meantime, have a great week. And this is Bill Cable from Media Now signing off. And sign off also from...
Well, Ian Purdy from ianpurdy.com, and you can get this show on the net, dadsontheair.net. Should be up from this afternoon. And, of course, Phil York from Dads in Distress as well.
Cheerio. See you all next week.
We're Dads on the Air. We're here cause we care. We ask all the questions that others don't dare. We're Dads on the Air. We're Dads on the Air.